citizens education events such as that as we're doing tonight, and we're also educating ourselves tonight because the league itself has no position on fracking. And so we haven't even started a formal process where we're studying fracking, but we know it's a very important controversial issue, so we would like to educate ourselves and get the public better informed about what the issues are. Speaking of voter service, on May 23rd, if you're a citizen of San Luis Obispo City, the League of Women Voters is sponsoring a candidates forum for the open city council seat. And that event is May 23rd, 5:30 to 7:30, and that's at the city council chambers. Okay, again, we have no position on fracking. We're here to learn. And before we ever take a position on anything, we always study it from anywhere from, we do a formal study from anywhere between 1 to 3 years. So we may eventually do a study on fracking, but we're not there yet. With that, I would like to turn this event over to Neil, and Neil Havlick, who is a member of our organization, and he will get things settled, get things stated as to the rules and what to expect for this evening, and introduce our panel members. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. I always like to start off by telling people I'm still sort of amazed that I'm a member of this organization because I always felt I was missing a fundamental qualification. But that is not the case, and both men and women are welcome to join the organization, and I've always admired the League of Women Voters, and I must say I'm very proud to be a member of that organization. Tonight we're having a panel discussion on the subject of hydraulic fracturing, which has been in the news a lot lately, not only in California, but perhaps even more so back east. There are some similarities and some differences between what is happening in places like Pennsylvania and New York State and what is happening in California, but there are also things that are very, very similar. And so the League, together with the Water Resources Advisory Committee of the County of San Luis Obispo, thought that this would be a very timely discussion to have to try to educate members of the community about the matter. And so we have in our panel tonight, we have some very distinguished guests who are all experts in their own way on the subject matter, and they will be talking about it, about the subject, and then we will have a question and answer session. So I'd like to start by introducing our panelists, and then just before we get started, I just have a few comments about the rules and some housekeeping. Our first speaker will be Mr. Tim Kustik. He is the director of the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources. And if you haven't heard the acronym DOGGER, you're going to hear it tonight, and you'll know what it means in the future. It's that division which is responsible for the regulation of oil, gas, groundwater protection council's board of directors. Thank you, Tim, and thank you for coming all the way from Sacramento to be here with us tonight. Our second speaker will be Grant Heimbaugh, and Grant is also an engineering geologist. He is with the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board here in San Luis Obispo. And in his position, he oversees numerous groundwater contamination cleanups, for example, at the former Fort Ord up there in Monterey, which is one of the largest Superfund sites in the nation. Prior to coming to the Water Board, Grant was a field engineer for Schlumberger Well Services and was then employed as a petrophysicist, and computer modeler by City Service Oil and Gas Company in Denver, and later with Occidental Petroleum's International Division. He holds a degree in engineering geology from the University of Illinois. Our third speaker is Dave Chipping. Dr. Chipping is an emeritus professor of geology at Cal Poly, where he had been since, I believe, 1971, been there for quite a while. Before that, he was a lecturer at UC Davis. This was after receiving his bachelor's degree in geology from Cambridge University in England, followed with a master's degree in Stanford in hydrogeology and a PhD in geology at Stanford. He's also the president of our local California Native Plant Society, active on the Friends of Carrizo Plain, which is an educational nonprofit out on the National Monument, and also is an alternate on the San Luis Obispo County Water Resources Advisory Committee. So if you would, please just join me in welcoming all of these folks. Okay, to begin, I'll just tell you about how we would do this. We're going to be kicked out of here at 9 o'clock. So we have some time, but we do have to pay a little bit of attention to the clock. Each of the presenters will give you their presentations. We have some; they have some PowerPoints. In addition, there is some information that at the end I think you can pick up over here from the division, from the folks at Dogger. Okay. And there's also a little bit of information about the League of Women Voters back on the back table if you would like to get that. The normal procedure that we use, and we'll be using that today, we'll go use our normal procedures, is that if you have a question, you write it down on a piece of paper, just raise your hand, and we have some runners who will collect the questions. We will not have direct questions going back and forth between members of the audience and the panel. And we ask you to save them for the end. If you want to direct them to one of the speakers, just put their name on it, Tim, Grant, or David, and we will do that. And then they are collected and sorted so that to avoid duplication, if there are two questions that are very similar or the same, then we'll just ask it once. So please bear with us with that rule. And then just one other housekeeping item. There are restroom facilities located outside the door here and to the left. The library itself, of course, is closed, but you can access the restroom facilities there. And with that, I would like to ask Tim to go ahead and start, and we'll get right into the program. Again, thank you all for coming. Tim.
Is this on?
It is?
Okay. Well, thank you, Neil. Thanks for inviting me down here. Although I miss the wife and children, it's always nice to get out of Sacramento, I assure you. So I spent 6 years living down in Santa Maria, so it's nice to get back into the Central Coast and enjoy the area. So I'm going to briefly talk about who the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources is, kind of a little real quick summary of oil and gas field operations in the state that have been going on for more than a century. Then I'm going to kind of focus in on hydraulic fracturing regulation, hydraulic fracturing operations in the state, and then I'm going to talk about a rulemaking that we're moving forward with for the regulation of hydraulic fracturing stimulation. So first of all, the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, we're a state regulatory agency. We regulate, historically, all of our authority was subsurface with oil and gas wells. We were actually created in 1915 because the oil industry couldn't regulate themselves from basically competition with each other. They were not producing the reservoirs as soundly as should be produced. So in an effort to protect the natural resources, they realized they needed regulation. So they went to the state legislature and created a regulatory body to make sure that wells were regulate the construction of the well, but we don't necessarily regulate where that well is in the state. So oil and gas operation in California, it began some 20 years at least before the Division of Oil and Gas and Geothermal Resources. It goes back, really commercial production is about 1880 is when it started, and then it's been boom and bust cycles throughout the years. There's over 215,000 oil and gas wells have been drilled in the state. Currently, there's about 80,000 what we call unabandoned, unplugged and abandoned wells. That's wells you drive out there, you could still see the well. They're not all active. There's about 20,000 of those wells are what we call idle wells. They're still there. They're not producing. but they're still on. You can still drive out there to see them. Of those 80,000 wells, nearly half of them are actually injection wells. And the reason we have injection wells in the state is because most of, and this is a little secret that the oil companies hate when I bring up, most of the oil companies in the state are misnamed. They're not oil companies. They're water production companies. They produce brackish, high TDS water from reservoirs that also have a little bit of oil in them. So for every barrel of oil they bring up, about 90 to 95% of it is water. It's not water that has little use in most cases. There are a few fields in the state that have relatively fresh water associated with the oil, but most of it is very high TDS water. It's really not used for anything other than to bring it up to the surface, strip the oil out of it, and then re-inject it back into the same formation to push more oil towards the producing wells. And then if they don't do that, the next most common end for that water is it's put into disposal wells, and disposal wells are usually into depleted oil reservoirs where there's low pressure and they can easily put the water back into that formation. And those are all regulated by us also, all the oil and gas and geothermal wells, including injection wells. And actually, the injection of fluid is our largest regulatory program in the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources. It takes nearly 50% of our resources now goes to some form of regulation of what we call the Underground Injection Control Program. So the oil industry has been around a long time, and hydraulic fracture stimulation is the term I use because that's the full descriptive term of what people refer to as fracking. Hydraulic fracture stimulation has been used in the state for over 50 years. It's not new. It's new in certain parts of the country. It's where it's been used in California is not new. It's been going on effectively for many years in California. We don't have a case yet of any damage to other natural resources caused by hydraulic fracturing stimulation. And then there's been tens of thousands of them in California already. Currently, there's about 700 wells a year being hydraulically fractured stimulated in the state. And these are all within, mostly within existing oil fields. In fact, there's two oil fields in Kern County that probably about 80% of all hydraulic fracture stimulation occurs in these two oil fields. One is South Belridge Oil Field, the other is Lost Hills. That's where the vast majority of hydraulic fracturing operation occurs in California. So, how did hydraulic fracturing become such a hot topic in the media and so many concerned citizens with concerns about it? It's been, like I said, it's been around a long time. It was actually developed in the late 40s, 50s, and the first place it was used, I don't know if anyone knows for sure. If you actually go back far enough, there was other forms of fracture stimulation that were not hydraulic. In the early days, actually before the division existed, people tried dropping dynamite and explosives down wells to fracture stimulate to see if they could increase production. So the idea of fracturing the rock formation to increase production is not new. It's been around a long time. The other thing that's been around a long time that you hear a lot about in the media when you see articles about hydraulic fracture stimulation is directionally drilling, or nowadays horizontal drilling. And directionally drilling wells has been around also a long time, over 50, 60 years. Offshore platforms, you have a small platform, but from that platform they can access reservoirs up to 6 miles away. So the ability to directionally drill has evolved with time. It was really probably in the 40s or 50s, it kind of took off. But when offshore, not only California, but the Gulf Coast has developed, that's when it was really rapidly applied to access areas that you couldn't drill straight vertically down to. So the reason hydraulic fracture stimulation has really taken off the last 10, 15 years is there was an oil operator in Texas that was looking at an oil deposit that was fairly deep. And as he drilled through a overlying shoosing interval of the shale, and then with hydraulic fracturing technology today, they can go back and through stages fracture stimulate over 10,000 feet plus of that wellbore all within a productive pay zone. So now suddenly the shale, which when you drilled vertically through might have been 50 or 100 feet, now you've got 10,000 feet of it exposed. So you have an economic well. So that was a technology that worked. It was proven in Texas. And then suddenly industry said, well, heck, if we can get the gas out of the shale, we know there's gas in shale in a lot of different places in the country. So they rapidly applied this technology in a number of other places in the country, Marcellus Shale and others that you've heard about. Meanwhile, back in California, hydraulic fracture stimulation was still being used mainly in vertical wells for production of oil, not natural gas, and in tight reservoirs. The reservoir wouldn't flow the oil, so they'd fracture stimulate and then get the oil out. So there was a radical change east of California, and industry went into areas that had never seen an oil and gas industry before and started putting in these long horizontal wells and fracture stimulating. And it got the attention of a lot of people living around. Suddenly there's huge truck traffic, there's a big use for water because hydraulic fracture stimulate 2 miles of reservoir takes a lot of water. So there was increased interest. That interest came to California, and people started asking, well, in California, we hydraulic fracture stimulating for shale gas in these long horizontal wells. And the division answered, no, because we're not, and we still haven't in California. We're not going into shale reservoirs and hydraulically fracturing long horizontal wells 2 miles long. We don't have them in California. Because California's geology is a little more complex, as we all know. Things are folded and faulted and bent around here. So generally, there is some horizontal wells, and industry is seeing if this technology that worked in these shale gas provinces, will it work in California to increase oil production? But to date, no one's really unlocked the key, but that doesn't mean they're not trying and they're looking. But, you know, this is a simplified cross-section, but here are productive oil zones and vertical well going through it. These are some faults. Most of the faults in California, although we have a number of active faults, we have far more old inactive faults. The thing to point out here is this is what we call a conventional reservoir, where the rocks have been folded over or the fault has actually trapped fluids in the reservoir. So fluids were not able to just migrate up to the surface. There was a confining layer above that was denser than perhaps this oil sand, and it prevented this oil from migrating any further up. In this case, this oil could have came from somewhere down here, migrated up, trapped in this area. But we call these conventional reservoirs. And here's another very simplified, where you have a slight bold fold or bend in the rock, and you're trapping oil and the saline water that's with the oil. Generally, the oil is lighter, so it'll be higher. And actually, you could also have a gas cap on top of this because gas is lighter than oil. But this is kind of what we call a conventional reservoir. This is what a very simplified, again, area, what we call an unconventional reservoir. There's not a trap. There's not a fold and a bend trapping gas and oil. The gas is actually trapped within the rock structure here. This is what happens in shale gas. The gas is trapped in that rock, so fracture stimulation is used to fracture that rock and allow the gas to come out. The other thing to point out here is most hydraulic fracturing occurs thousands of feet below any freshwater aquifers. In California, freshwater aquifers, you know, they're generally less than 2,000, quite often less than 1,000 feet deep. Hydraulic fracturing, although we do have it shallow in some places, the places that shallow don't have fresh water. And the places that where they're experimenting with this kind of technology in California, the hydraulic fracturing is on order of 8 to 10,000 feet deep. And the aquifers, you know, on the order of 1,500 to 1,000 feet. So even though you might see a well right next to a water well, in reality, where the fracture stimulation is a couple miles away down the hole. So it's not right next to the water. So what does the division do when it comes to oil and gas operations? Well, one of the main things we do when it relates to hydraulic fracturing, I don't have time to go into everything we do, but one of the main things we do is we regulate every oil and gas and geothermal well drilled in the state. And how we regulate is we make sure that they all have casing that is cemented across the productive zones to make sure that oil from the productive zone, once you drill into it, this is the productive zone, the oil zone, it can't migrate along the casing and into some other zone. We also require casing and cementing across the aquifers to make sure that that water cannot somehow dump down into an oil zone and contaminate an oil zone, or the oil cannot migrate into the water zone. So that's one of the basic requirements that all we make sure this occurs and make sure that these seals are adequate, and they we pressure test casing. That's actually specified in these regulations I'll talk about in just a minute. This annular space is important because operators are required to monitor this space, and if there is any kind of failure of this tubing, the first line of protection, you would see a pressure spike, and then the operators would have to shut down and address whatever the problem was. So with that, I'm going to move into our regulations. Now, we have extensive regulations on the books already. What we're in the process of doing now, and there's a handout over there on the side table to talk about the rulemaking process. And this is how the state agency goes about creating more regulations. But we're actually before this page even started. What we did is, a year ago, we went around the state, had 7 information gathering workshops where we explained hydraulic fracturing in a little more detail than I just did. We had a little more time. But we talked about it, and then we took input from the public. We did that in 7 different locations. We went back and wrote what we call a discussion draft of the regulations. We released those in December, and now we just last week in Monterey, we finished our last workshop, and these were workshops that lasted 6 and 7 hours, where we stepped through these regulations in great details with interested individuals, and they gave us input on what changes they saw needed to be done in the regulations. And we also took the opportunity to educate them a lot about the oil and gas operations. So we anticipate that we'll start this actual process this summer, and then we're going to go through the rulemaking process, which will require more public meetings to gain more input on these regulations. But the intent with our regulations is to go beyond where our current regulations are, which address, when it comes to hydraulic fracturing, the main thing is the well construction. These regulations, which I'll step through now, are going to, in addition to that, they require, oops, that was not my pointer. Well, that moves fast. It requires cement evaluation before hydraulic fracturing, even though they run them when they initially complete a well. If you had an older well that you're going to hydraulic fracture stimulate, you'd have to rerun those evaluation logs. You have to look at the area. The fracture radial analysis is you have to look at that point of the fracture stimulation, and if you propose and model the fracture to go out perhaps 500 feet, you have to look at a radius 1,000 feet around that point to see if you're going to have the possibility of intersecting any existing well bores that could make sure that they have good integrity so they couldn't be an avenue for anything to leave the zone. And you also have to evaluate any faults in that area. Do they have the ability to have fluid migrate? And additionally, there was one other thing that just slipped my mind. Just trying to hit on the high points here. Fracture radial. Oh, and then if the fracture could reach the confining layer, the cap rock that holds the oil in the reservoir down below, then you have to do an analysis of the cap rock. Cap rock's always stronger and more dense than the reservoir rock because it actually trapped the oil below it. But if the fracture radial analysis could reach that cap rock, then you have to do an analysis of that cap rock to make sure that it will, at the point any fracture could reach it, it doesn't have enough power or force to actually fracture the cap rock. The other thing, they have to pressure test the well and, of course, the surface equipment before they conduct a fracture stimulation. Also in the regulations, they have to give Dogger advance notice. The 10-day comes from our current permitting scheme, which is not adequate. We've already heard that for public notification, so we know that's going to be changed so the public can have more notification of hydraulic fracture stimulation. They have to give us 24 hours notice before they hydraulically fracture stimulate, just so we can have our field engineers out there on site. And actually, 24 hours is probably more than we really need. We have engineers on call 24/7 to go out to witness various operations in the oil and gas field. Okay, and then so during hydraulic fracturing operations, they have to continuously monitor. They have to stop if there's a spike or drop in pressure that's unexpected and have to evaluate that to make sure that they don't have a problem. And then there's additional monitoring of wells that have been hydraulically fractured stimulated for the first 30 days and for the first 5 years. I mean, they already have to monitor the wells and report on the wells, but there's additional ones for those that have been hydraulically fractured stimulated. And again, this is just the discussion draft of regulations. We're getting a lot of feedback, and these are going to be modified. We know that before they go out this summer. The disclosure, this has been a very hot topic when it comes to hydraulic fracturing stimulation. That is, people want to know, you know, what is the vast majority of fluid used in hydraulic fracturing is just what we call makeup. So at this point in time, it's in our discussion draft regulations, but there's already legislation out there that says, no, we have to develop our own site. So we don't know what's coming out of the legislature. So for now, we'd like to see frac focus. We think it would, with modifications, it'll meet our need, but the legislature may override us on that one. Trade secrets is another challenging issue. Sometimes the operators hire a service company to perform the hydraulic fracture stimulation. And those service companies have special mixes that they have proprietary, thank you, information on those mixes. So that they have trade secret protection. And that's another section of California law that, you know, we really have nothing to do with. So in certain situations, we can't require them to divulge the trade secret. But in our regulations, it does say if there's a spill or if we need it for our purposes, you have to give it to us. Or if an emergency medical folks need it for their purposes, you have to provide it. So this is something that is very contentious, and the legislature's wrestling with it, and we're attempting to do our best to wrestle with this animal too. One of the concerns we have is we need to have protection. If they do give it to us, and then we get a Public Records Act request, and we have to give it up, if we violate someone's trade secret, then we're subject to a trade secret suit. And, you know, we have enough suits going already. We don't want to be a target for another easy lawsuit. So we're trying to figure out a way, either through regulation or legislation, to make sure that the information that's needed is known by the people that need it, but yet at least our agency in the state is protected from lawsuits that, you know, could essentially, you know, cost the taxpayers a lot of money. This is more about trade secret. The regulations require that if you do give it to a medical professional or even to us, we have to maintain it as confidential. And that's the part where they have to give it to us if we need it. So I think, storage and handling. For the most part, this is our current draft regulations, but a lot of this just reaffirms already existing regulations. That is, if you spill something out in the oil field, you have to clean it up. You already have to have a spill contingency plan. This reaffirms that if you have hydraulic fracture stimulation fluids out there, that has to be part of your contingency plan. And you can't have hydraulic fracture stimulation fluid stored in unlined sumps. And I think there's legislation pending right now that says you can't even have it in a sump. It has to all be in tanks or some kind of container. So that might be a moot point in the near future. Of course, they have to clean up spills and they have to report. We actually put in these regulations an additional reporting requirement. They have to do an analysis. If they have some kind of an unauthorized release, they have to do an analysis and file a report with us within 5 days exactly what happened, what was the cause of it, and how they're going to prevent it. And that's so we can disseminate that information. I think that's the last slide. I don't know if I took more than 15 or... I didn't get any signs, so I'm okay. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you, Tim. And Grant will now talk to us about the subject matter from his angle, which is that of the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. Grant.
Just a little bit of my background in case you want to take advantage when you're thinking of questions that you want to ask. I originally got into the petroleum business. I worked for Schlumberger Well Services. Yes? You can't hear?
Can't hear. A little closer to the mic.
I worked for Schlumberger Well Services. It's one of the service companies that Tim was referring to. And I was a borehole geophysicist. I was a field engineer initially. I was basically one of the people that goes out to the well site and lowers geophysical equipment down the borehole and takes a bunch of measurements to determine where the oil is, how much oil there is, all the physical properties of the rock behind the casing, whether there's casing or not. We have all sorts of different tools. They were based on nuclear physics, sonar, and electrical resistivity and conductivity. And basically, after I got done with that, I went to work for City Service Oil and Gas, or CITGO, in Denver. I worked in the Rocky Mountain region. So I have a fair amount of familiarity with the Bakken Shale, which is getting a lot of publicity right now. There's a huge drilling boom up there in North Dakota. I did a fair amount of work up there. I am familiar with the Bakken. It's much, much different than the Monterey Shale that we have here in California. And I'll contrast that a bit later. And after that, then I came to work for Occidental in Bakersfield in their international division. A little bit about the Regional Water Board, in case you're not familiar with it. We tend to get a lot of publicity from things like PG&E fines, Unical at Avila Beach, also Los Osos. So we're no stranger to publicity. And we do have a lot of enforcement ability. We're no stranger to that process. We get a lot of public feedback. We hold meetings. We used to be almost every month. Now it's more like, on average, every other month. We have 7 board members who are from the greater community that represent different parts, so like local government, agriculture. We have people who are university professors, very technical people, and then we take people from the general population as well. We have 7 board members, and we get a lot of public feedback at meetings just like this, our board meetings, where we have all seven board members, and the public really gives us a lot of feedback. So we're no stranger to that process, although when we do levy some fines, they're usually in the $1,000 to, in the case of PG&E, I believe it was in the tens of millions of dollars. Same for Unical. So when we do take action, when we do protect your groundwater and your surface water, I mean, people do take notice. So we are not toothless tigers. Okay, our watersheds. Our watershed for the Sun Coast region goes roughly from Santa Cruz down to Santa Barbara. And everything that flows west to the Pacific Ocean is what we protect. If it goes east towards the Central Valley, then that's the Central Valley Water Board. There's 9 water boards in the state. And again, we're the Central Coast. So the oil fields that we typically get involved in that are currently in operation would be, the best example would be San Ardo. On 101, it's on the right-hand side as you're going north, past Robles and past Camp Roberts. Let's see, go one more. My goals tonight. What I really want to get across to everyone is that I get a lot of questions at work. I get a lot of questions in my neighborhood about hydraulic fracturing. You know, what's the real deal? Some people know that I used to work in the business, and they'd say, like, okay, we want the insider's view. And I said, well, it's pretty complicated, not to be condescending or anything, but it's actually so multifaceted. And so I started giving it more and more thought because I'd get more and more questions from people that would stop and ask me. And they said, well, we want your insider's perspective. And I started to realize that these people were getting pretty frustrated because there is a lot of stuff out in the media. And I was realizing that they were feeling like I feel, kind of ironically, since we're dealing with illegal women voters, they feel like I feel when I'm going through my ballot initiatives and I'm reading about the pro and the con arguments, and I'm reading the pro and I'm thinking, okay, I'm for it. And then I go and I read the argument against it and I'm going, oh, wait a minute, I'm in trouble here, because now I'm feeling like I'm totally against it. And I'm feeling like, okay, someone's not totally forthcoming on this thing. And so I thought, okay, I really do sympathize with the public on this one because it's not a simple thing. So I've spent a lot of my personal time actually preparing and going through this because I want to get back up to speed. I haven't been in the petroleum business for 20-some years, but once a petrophysicist, borehole geophysicist, basically I did it long enough, it definitely didn't leave me. So it is what it is. This is something that I tell a lot of people on a lot of different projects, and I hear myself saying it a lot on the phone. And what it is that the successes and failures of hydraulic fracturing or hydraulic stimulation are very site-specific. Very site-specific. California geology, I can't emphasize enough, and Tim alluded to it earlier, is not the same as geology in other parts of the country. It's not the same as in Pennsylvania with the Marcellus Shale. Marcellus Shale gets a lot of publicity. If you listen to NPR, you'll hear a lot about the Marcellus Shale. If you listen to Democracy Now! At lunchtime, you'll hear a lot about it. Our geology is quite different. It's different than most anywhere in the nation, really. And also, our environmental regulatory framework, not the same as in other parts of the country. We have a much more structured, much more comprehensive regulatory framework than in most other areas of the country. Okay, this is just a graphic to let you know afforded a much more marketable commodity in the petroleum business than the natural gas. Natural gas, you have to store it, you need pipelines, it's not compact in terms of BTUs per unit area. Oil is much more desirable. Okay, then the Marcellus Shale up here in the east, you know, that's where we get all the interest from films like Gasland. Gasland was also in Colorado. It was in southwest Wyoming, if I can find that from my angle here. It's kind of severe. Gasland was also down in Texas. They did some interviews down in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But out here, where we are in California, we have the Monterey Shale, and it is so much different, and I'll go into that further. The Monterey Shale is deeper than a lot of other petroleum formations, shales. As Tim mentioned, it's so unpredictable relative to others, say compared to the Bakken. It's going up, it's going down, the thickness varies. In the sense of predictability, I consider it, although I've never worked with it directly professionally, I consider it kind of a geologic nightmare. It's difficult. But we've got some things really going well for us in California regarding this whole deal. Out of the Monterey, we have petroleum. In fact, for the whole state, we have predominantly oil, not natural gas. And the benefit of that is that this is something I used to do in the petroleum profession. We worked a lot with permeability of rock. And when you've got permeability, you've got different permeabilities. One, to gas phase, to air phase type fluids. And another, to liquid phase, like oil. And the difference between the two is huge. So when we've got oil, liquid phase, petroleum in California, it's much to our benefit because it's so much more difficult to move liquid phase oil through rock than it is gas. And the gist of that is that when you see documentaries like Gasland, and they have unintended consequences, and the gas goes to places they don't want it, it's largely because that gas, that the bedrock is so much more permeable. It allows that gas to move so much more readily, and I'm talking anywhere from 200 to well over 1,000 times more permeability, easier to move gas through rock than it is liquid fluids. So we have a huge benefit in that we have predominantly, not just predominantly, but with a few exceptions, oil is it, especially for the Monterey Shale in California. Okay, and also we have going for us, our regulations are much more comprehensive, they're tighter, and not to be lost, our political environment, our politicians are so much more responsive than some other countries where it's just different. I'm not going to criticize anyone else. We just have a different environment for that politically. Okay, here's just a simple graphic with the, roughly where the Monterey Shale is in California, in red here, and estimated 15 billion barrels. By industry standards, that's huge. A world-class oil field, so like in the Middle East, billion barrels. I mean, a billion-barrel oil field will turn a large company around financially. A large company like, you know, when I worked for Occidental, we had a billion-barrel discovery in Colombia. It was huge for the company, absolutely huge. For most companies, and that was an international, where you expected to have big discoveries. In domestic oil production, 50 million, 100 million, that was really big. Okay, and now here domestically, and they're saying we've got 15 billion barrels, it is truly huge. Now, the devil's in the details. The details are that how easy is it to get that oil out of here? And the details are that a lot of that oil is dispersed, a lot of it is shallow, a lot of it is very heavy oil. And when it gets heavier, the heavier it gets. Remember, liquid, so much more difficult to move through rock than gas. Well, when it gets heavy, when it gets like motor oil, when it gets like tar or bunker fuel, you know, just really thick, sludgy stuff, you can pretty well forget about it. Especially when it comes to horizontal well drilling. When it comes to horizontal well drilling, as Tim described, you need at least oil that's in the, well, in the industry we call it true Monterey Shale production, is actually smaller than this area outlined in red. And the gist of his work was that based on standard temperature and pressure conditions that are needed to form oil in the subsurface, he had collected enough data that he felt fairly comfortable that the Monterey Shale had to have a depth of at least 10,000 feet minimum in order to contain petroleum in the form of oil that would be economic, that would flow through a horizontal well, that would basically be of any desire to the major oil companies in California. The major oil companies being Chevron, Era, which is a subsidiary of Exxon and Shell, and the other one would be Occidental. Okay, this is just to give you an example of just how responsive our political environment is. As Tim knows, in the last 4 or 5 months, we've been getting deluged with proposed legislation regarding hydraulic fracturing or stimulation. And I'm not going to go into detail on any of these, but I just want to show it to you as an example of your politicians are at work. And that I also want to mention that there is a feedback loop. They don't do these things in a vacuum. We have legislative analysts in Sacramento, and they often get on the phone and they call me and a person from the Central Valley Water Board and someone else from the Los Angeles Water Board. And we conference call, and we discuss any of the proposed legislation that involves the regional water boards. And we give them our practical feedback on, do we think it's going to work? Do we think it's really enforceable? Do we think there are scientific problems with it? All those different types of things, so that we don't get hopefully a piece of bad legislation. So there is a feedback loop, and so far, this is the first time I've really been involved in it in great detail, but so far it works. Okay, a quick word about air issues. There are, as I've seen in the media, a lot of concerns about air issues, people inhaling vapors associated with oil production. This is typically associated with natural gas production. And I imagine people looked at the video Gasland. A lot of that film actually concentrated on air emissions from natural gas wells. And a lot of that had to do with that there were condensate tanks at the surface that were openly venting to the atmosphere. That doesn't happen in California. We have air pollution control districts. We have one for San Luis County, one for Santa Barbara County, and one for the Monterey Bay area with three counties. And I've spoken with Mike Sewell up at Monterey Bay recently, and we had a detailed discussion about San Ardo oil field. And even though they're not fracking, even though it's not natural gas, they have vapor recovery there. So even with the much, much more minimal threat that they have there compared to what they have in other parts of the country with natural gas production, they still regulate it. They still insist on vapor recovery. So another big check mark for California. Another reason I feel much more comfortable with this issue, and something that I want to impart to you. Okay. Now, there's an entire spectrum of opinions out there, so you know, I just wanted people to be conscious of who you choose to believe, because basically there are just tons of opinions out there. I want you to maintain a healthy skepticism. Ask yourself, who are these people? Why should I believe them? Do they have any expertise in the area? And just to hit on my conclusion, remember that hydraulic fracturing is complex. It's very site-specific in whether it works well. We have everything going for us. We lucked out. We got the right geology. We've got the right petroleum type. We've got the right regulatory structure, and we've got the correct political responsiveness, things we do by choice. So that's it. Here's my contact information. I want to thank the League because I think they do really good work.
Thank you, Grant. And now we'll finish up with David's presentation. David.
Thank you. Unlike the other two speakers, I only work under one regulatory framework. That's my wife. And how do we get this to go? Do I have to... Oh, can someone get that to go into the actual slideshow? Some of those in the Central Valley, for example, or San Ardo, contain boron, which is poisonous to plants. So there's a definite issue in terms of what you do with your production water. In addition, there is an issue with the Monterey in that it is, in many fields, quite a wet formation anyway. So you've got your fracking fluids going down the well, and you've also got the other water which is being produced. And one of the big issues with industry and the regulation of water that comes up is what exactly are you regulating? Are you going to be regulating the frack return water from the process, or are you going to continue regulating over the total water production of the well? And this is, I believe, brought up by Fran Pavley in her bill. Nothing is decided there. Most of the well testing inspection, I'm sort of pleased with what we hear from DAGA. DAGA is, however, under challenge. There are is a lawsuit. I don't know the details of it and whether they have been resolved by the new regulations, but there is a degree of commentary going on the new pre-rulemaking discussion draft. And that, of course, remains to be seen what's going to be happening with that. Issues of surface occupancy, duration and reoccupation are a big issue. This is what the main problem was in the big eastern gas fields, where, of course, a non-industrial landscape becomes an industrial landscape. And we can see from what we've heard here that it's unlikely that we're going to see that kind of geographical disposition of wells. But nonetheless, it is an issue. If you do have a mineral right below your property, and it was a possibility for exploitation by the mineral rights owner, so it has a property right, what is the surface occupancy, duration, how many times do you go back to the site and refrack? certainly on the shale sites, some wells were refracked as many as, or are intended to be refracked as many as 15 times during the life of the well. So it's a big question of surface use versus underground use. It's a property rights issue for both sites. And, of course, we've dealt with the fracking fluid ingredients industrial secrets issue. What exactly is the control that we have? We hear that Dogger really does not have any regulation in regard to the well siting, so who does? And it turns out there is some regulation associated with setbacks. Dogger does have, I believe, a minimum distance between wells and some other things like that, and a setback from property line. The rules are actually quite complicated in regard to that because it's many paragraphs in length and depends on the configuration of the property. But it is actually possible under certain configurations of land to have a well within 25 foot of a boundary, including roads. Mostly they're talking about, I think, 100 foot back or something like that. But the county, if you look at our land use element, only basically responds to what are in the state regulations such as they are. And that is a problem. And now, in two little papers I wrote, which you can access in the county, I did them for RAC, and they were informational things. They are at the county engineering website. If you do the county engineering, look for the RAC pages, and you'll find two things there. And I got to look at
RAC. What is it?
Water Resources Advisory Committee. I'm sorry.
SlocumbyWater.org.
Yes. Thank you. So I took a look at what is going on nationally in regard to surface occupiers, cities, etc., trying to keep fracking out. And it's actually turned out to be rather bad. That is, that lower courts will frequently vote for the city. But as you go higher and higher in the judicial system, the property rights of the mineral owners begin to raise higher and higher. And successful lawsuits only seem to have been on when you can actually prove there has been damage. And that is a health damage, water well damage, or something like that. But it seems to be very difficult to zone against oil in your area, and none of these have gone to the Supreme Court. One is just about to reach the New York State Supreme Court. But it doesn't look good if you think you can say, no, we won't have fracking. There's a lot of other issues, as we've heard from Dogger, that are used, steam flooding, huff and puff, all kinds of other things. I'm not sure that any of them are any better than fracking, and we've heard that fracking's been used without any problems in California for a long time. But map of active oil leases. There are currently 42 active oil leases in the county with 30,748 acres in total. You can see where they're located. And they are located largely in the fringes against Kern County and the Temblers, and in the areas that are down in the there's my little laser here. That didn't work. Laser, there we go. Down in this area in here, coming down in towards the ranges in here, there is Monterey and stuff in there, and some Cretaceous plays, I believe, and things like that. Not really the kind of place you'd probably go fracking very much. So you can see, very largely, nobody's doing much in the county because we don't have any oil here. So it's not actually a major problem for us in San Luis Obispo County, not in residential areas. In tracking lawsuits, there have been a couple of interesting ones that have shown that there has been probable fault on the part of the oil companies. Range Resources versus Hallowich in Pennsylvania was settled with sealed documents, and so was Dymock, Pennsylvania. That's Residence versus Cabot Oil. These appear to be methane in wells issues brought in by the movie Gasland, for example. Others EPA has been in rather serious trouble with the industry because both in Dish, Texas and Pavilion, Wyoming, it appears that the EPA testing was itself contaminated and badly done. In other words, EPA screwed up, but badly, in two cases. So the industry is litigating against EPA for poor quality assurance. And there's another case in Rosebud, Alberta, it involves Encana, which was in Pavilion, but I haven't got the results on that one yet. In addition, Earth Justice has a site in which they list a very large number of what they call fraccidents or whatever, and it's worth looking at. Very few of them seem to have got to a significant litigation. There is also a related case which is interesting, and that is on the reinjected fluids getting loose. And in Arkansas, there is a group that are suing because reinjected fluid has apparently contaminated an aquifer. So this is a sort of secondary tier to the fracking. You wouldn't have got the fluid unless you fracked. You're getting rid of that fluid, but now you've caused a problem there. The water use issue is very controversial. Enormous amounts, these are in millions of gallons, quantity of water used for a shale gas well in the east. But you'll see that in California, with the geology, which we had explained to us very nicely, is so different, probably 80,000 to 300,000 gallons per well. The industry here points out that we're sort of in the golf course watering sort of modes and that sort of thing. But I'm not quite sure how you make those comparisons. But it doesn't seem to be nearly as bad as the situations on water use elsewhere. This issue of chemicals is interesting. House Commerce Committee had a minority report on what that 1-5% of chemicals are that go into the liquid. 750 chemicals, apparently, and many of them quite nasty. And this is one of the reasons why there's this question of revelation. I've only got about 1% in some cases additives. I believe I heard some different information from Dogger. Maybe it's slightly higher than 1% additives. But anyway, the trade secrets issue is under challenge in several bills, including the Wieckowski bill. One of the big issues, of course, is that a frack fluid would have a fingerprint. And if you have a contamination issue, then you simply would bring in your contaminated water. It would be fingerprinted against the index water. And I'm sure some middle ground was probably useful where you wouldn't normally reveal what it was unless there's a case. And then when you had a case, then you could do it under a secure situation as a comparison of whether there was fault or not. And I suspect that's maybe where the things will go. The interesting situation, Sanado would represent a very typical sort of Monterey-type water. There's some papers there that show that it is very, very high in TDS. The only way they could bring down the TDS to use it again is to go through reverse osmosis. When you think of gross energy use, to use RO uses a phenomenal amount of electricity, so you wonder about your energy efficiency if you're using RO. But also it contains boron, which is toxic for a great number of crops, so you have a real problem with that. And this is another issue. In many cases, formation water would have to be separated from the general water supply unless you can afford to get the stuff out. And these gentlemen would know better than I whether it's being done and whether there's boron removal. I don't know. The Energy Policy Act of 2005, the Halliburton loophole, of course, exempted, and this is brought up in Gasland, the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, and CERCLA were all exempted in terms of water that's being put down a fracking well. But the of course, we do have Port of Cologne and the Regional Water Quality Control Board. So as soon as we have water on the surface, these guys can take over. So we do have some sort of control. There was another issue brought up about earthquakes. Can fracking generate earthquakes? It has done in the past, deliberately, in Rangeley, Colorado. Water was injected into a fault zone in an oil field by the USGS to see if they could generate earthquakes. They could. In Rocky Mountain Arsenal, they injected water under pressure into a fault zone and generated earthquakes. You can see the injection against the earthquakes. And from here, I can't tell which is which now, but they coincide. Injection pulses caused earthquakes. So far, though, as far as I can see, there aren't very many major earthquakes generated. I think one 2.8 or something in Oklahoma or something. I think I've said all we need to say about that. Well, setback issues, one well per acre, apparently 150 foot from next well, that's Dogger, 100 foot from street or outer boundary of parcel, can be down to 25 feet, mention that. And finally, drill pad size, if you do happen to run into a surface rights, mineral rights issue, and you do have them come in, the size occupied by a fracking operation is very, very large indeed. A lot of equipment comes in. And the setbacks that we talked about are done from the well, not from the edge of the disturbed parcel. So you may be 100 foot from the well, but this stuff that's surrounding it can come very, very close to you. And as far as I know, county land use has made no sense of this sort of problem that might come. So that's about me, I think. So, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, David, and the other panelists. We'll take just a second if you want to just stand up and kind of stretch for a minute, and then we'll start. I have questions here. We'll start to read them out, and then our panelists will respond. Okay? Thank you very much. Okay, folks, if you go ahead, take your seats again, and we'll get started on the question and answer.
Big safety issue. In our regulations, in the discussion draft regulations, we require, I didn't get into all the details, I simply didn't have enough time, but we require Before they even start pressure hydraulic fracture stimulation, they have to pressure test all of the surface equipment to 110% of the anticipated fracture pressure, that the maximum pressure they'll use during the frac job. So that's and then the other question was about earthquakes.
How long are they guaranteed, and what if there's an earthquake?
Well, how long are they guaranteed? I mean, fracture stimulation operations, unless you're doing one of these very long horizontal frac jobs, that could take a matter of a few days. But fracture stimulation, typically in California, is on the matter of an hour or so. They fracture stimulate it, they're done, they put the well in production, it might produce for 20, 30, 40 years. So it's not a long-term, that kind of pressure is not long-term at all. You fracture stimulate and you're done.
And earthquakes?
Earthquakes. So there have been earthquakes associated with oil-filled operations, but it's not from hydraulic fracturing stimulation, where you're applying high pressures for a matter of minutes or a few hours in a particular rock segment. Where earthquakes have been shown to happen is the injection wells, where you take the produced water, like I said, 90% plus of the fluid in oil fields in California is produced water. Sustained injection, where you're putting water down wells, these injection wells, for years, decades at a time, has led to earthquakes, but not in California. The reason not in California is because when you do injection, most of it, you're injecting back into the same zone you're producing from, because it's a water flood. You flood it with water to push the oil. So you're not increasing the pore pressure. You're putting water in, but you're taking water out. So the pore pressure is not increasing. That's the pressure in between the rock grains. When you get earthquakes is when you start increasing the rock pressure to break it. Now hydraulic fracturing stimulation, let me go back a little bit. It does cause earthquakes, but it's micro-seismic events, like on the order of magnitude negative 0.3 on the Richter scale. It's something you're never going to notice from just hydraulic fracturing, because you are breaking these rocks, but that alone is not going to be any earthquake that you would ever notice on the surface. But there have been cases with sustained long injection, like the Rocky Mountain Arsenal that David indicated, where there was sustained injection, increased the pore pressure, and led to earthquakes. And it has happened in Ohio, and again, when you're talking about, let me, a little more detail on oil field operations or dry shale gas operations. When they're hydraulically fracturing in these dry shale plays east of California, they're importing water to fracture stimulate, because it's a dry shale, they don't have the water there. So there's essentially no water in the shale. So they fracture stimulate, and then they produce back water. They're only going to produce it back for days or maybe a few weeks until they get the gas, and then they're going to have gas come to the surface. And they build an infrastructure for the gas, because the gas is the product they're pursuing. They don't build an infrastructure for the water, because the water is only coming back for a matter of days or weeks. So they produce the water back and then truck it off to a disposal well. Well, for the most part, in many of these areas, especially in the Marcellus, they don't have major oil field operations nearby that have depleted oil reservoirs where they can put this water. So in some cases, they were putting water and increasing the pore pressure, the native pore pressure, in that disposal well area, and that generated earthquakes. In California, we already have the water cycling through the oil fields. We already have depleted oil reservoirs. So when it comes to water from hydraulic fracturing, it's a minor amount of water. In the state right now, we produce about 200,000 barrels of oil a year. We produce 3 billion barrels of water a year, and that's mostly injected. If you took all the frac fluid from 1 year of fracking in the state, the volume of fluid would represent about 0.02% of all of the fluid that's injected in the state. So the water is a very small volume. Sorry.
Thank you. Anybody want to take a minute to add anything? David?
One slight thing, and that was apparently in a comparison with other state regulations, some are much more.
But
it's down there on the.
Oh, okay. There we go. Sorry. So the states vary a lot with what they do, but a couple of states have a longer pressuring period than California. And it has been suggested that when you're pressurizing your well to make sure you have no casing leaks, that it should be done for a longer amount of time.
Okay. Next question. This one is again directed to Tim. Can you please comment on the Kern County issue where farmers and growers have lost orchards after what I believe was fracking occurred? And that may be a mistake, but that's the question.
Yeah, that has been represented that way. In fact, there was one organization out of the Bay Area that put in a report they did that the contamination was related to fracking, and it was not at all. It was... the situation was an almond orchard, and a farmer he didn't have the best water, but his water quality was such that he could blend it with fresh water and water his orchard. There was adjacent, kind of upstream from his property, there were these big, what they call evaporation ponds, where they take the produced water instead of reinjecting it, they put it out in these broad ponds and let it evaporate off. So it had nothing to do with fracture stimulation. It was the produced water that was put in these evaporation ponds. And those ponds leaked, and that was the nature of the lawsuit. The leaking of those ponds contaminated the aquifer that this farm... I mean, that was the alleged in the lawsuit. I didn't study this, but I just read the literature. The failure, the subsurface failure of those ponds leached into the aquifer that the farmer was using. It wasn't... The pond itself is actually regulated, and the permit for that is the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board was actually the permitting agency for that.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Grant?
So, no, you
okay.
Well covered it.
Okay. What is the potential, or is there potential for sinkholes to arise out of this, out of these processes?
No, not. if there are two ways you could develop sinkholes, you know, one is by in some way washing out the subsurface. So I guess it would be remotely possible that if you had a artesian sort of well with vast amounts of pressure coming up and it broke the casing below the surface and it flushed out a cavity, then you could have a sinkhole. But it's extremely unusual for that to happen. There have been cases in the early days of Kern County where gas and oil would come up around casings, badly built casings, and basically flush out everything around the casing and the whole thing would crater, but that was extremely rare that that would happen.
Okay. Going back to... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just add that there have been instances, as David indicated, that certain oil-filled operations have resulted in surface failures or subsidence, but it's not from hydraulic fracture stimulation.
Okay. This may go back a bit to some of basic, but I think it's important to mention this. And what is the purpose of the chemicals in the mix in a water well, which is pressurized to cause hydraulic fracturing? The purpose of the chemicals.
It's a variety, but Tim's more conversant in that.
Ideally, what they put in the water will vary by every formation, pretty much, even by the depth. So the mix they use in the Marcellus is probably radically different than the mix they use in the Bakken. And it even within California, the things that they're using in Lost Hills is, I'm sure, different than what they're using in South Belridge. And what they want the fluid to do is they want it to be relatively easy to pump, but yet... it has to be thick enough that it will carry the proppant, so the proppant doesn't just like fall out of suspension and just plug up somewhere. So they want the fluid to be kind of like ketchup-like, and actually one of the ingredients they use to do that is guar gum, which is put in ketchup. And it to hold the sand in suspension, and then it goes into the formation, but then you put in what they call a breaker that actually breaks that so it turns less like ketchup and more like vinegar, so you can get the fluid back out of the well. So it's basically to give the fluid the physical properties needed to stimulate the fracture within that formation, and the chemistry of the rock can also impact what chemicals you have to put in the fracture stimulation fluid, because you don't want to put something in there that's going to cause rock to swell and then collapse the pore space or make it less permeable. So it gets kind of technical pretty quick.
Y'all got that? Okay. Here's one, just to go off to another area outside of San Luis Obispo County. Is fracking allowed in Europe? And if so, under what regulations?
It is. Actually, yeah. Poland is having a rapid expansion of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracture stimulation. That's about the only country. I just went to a luncheon talk a few months back, and the speaker was talking about his involvement in acquiring leasing properties. And so I know for sure it's happening in Poland. I think either France or England, someone just outright banned it, I believe, and I'm not positive on that.
Street demonstration in London.
So I guess the short answer is yes. Is another one primarily for Tim. With the state budget, are there enough departmental resources to make sure regulation is being followed and enforced?
We actually had that same question asked to us by a Senate panel on hydraulic fracture stimulation. So we know the answer to that one. We have the legislature has provided us with additional resources, primarily staffing, for the last four fiscal years. So we've had a significant increase in the order of 40%. Part of it is to deal with hydraulic fracture stimulation regulation. Another part is to deal with underground injection control regulation. We made it very clear to the legislature, we're filling these positions, we're working on the regulations. If we don't have enough resources, we certainly know how and who to ask for additional resources. And we made that. The general fund doesn't affect, it does, but only for political reasons. It doesn't affect our budget. We are specially funded, and there's an assessment on every barrel of oil and 10,000 feet of gas produced in the state. They pay us about 14 cents out of every barrel of oil that's produced, and that funds the regulatory program. However, the legislature sets that assessment. We simply collect it. The legislature sets our spending authority, so it's not like if they produce more oil, we have more funding. That relationship doesn't exist. We're strictly, the amount we can spend in our program is set by the legislature. But we know how to get more resources if we need.
Okay. Anybody else?
Well, I was curious, okay. Is the rest of money back to the general fund that you don't use?
No, if we don't spend what we have the authority for, it gets essentially refunded back to the operators, because the assessment for the next fiscal year will be somewhat reduced from what it would have been because there was a surplus.
I'll give you a bottom line. How many wells per inspector, and how often do they get visited?
Well, it varies, because if you're doing a plug-in and abandonment, we might be out there for the same well four or five times in a week, versus one that's just sitting there producing away, we might only get to it every year or every year and a half. I don't have the number of wells per inspector, but I'm not sure that we could come up with that, certainly.
Okay. Here's another one that, again, maybe sort of revisits some of the discussion, but I think it gets to the point. It says that the department regulates the manufacture and operation of wells, but what about the waste removal, storage, and disposal created by the hydraulic fracturing process? Anybody care to tackle that one?
That last line, the waste removal?
Waste removal, storage, and disposal created by the hydraulic fracturing process.
So essentially we're talking about the spent hydraulic fracture stimulation fluid as it comes back up the well, I take
it. That's what it sounds like.
So when that, again, California oil fields are 90% water. So when a well is hydraulically fractured stimulated using fresh water, proppant, and some chemicals, that gets put into the well. The production comes back. It's then considered a produced fluid. Once anything comes out of a well, it's considered a produced fluid. So a produced fluid is an EPA Class 2 fluid. Then it falls under our underground injection control program. So that it basically moves from the production end of our regulations over to our underground injection control, and it's regulated as it's generally put down existing injection wells within oil and gas fields.
Okay. Anybody else?
Okay. Covers it.
Okay. Here's another question. I think we kind of answered this, but again, it can be revisited. Are there any possible long-term geologic repercussions from the fracturing of bedrock? Let's think in terms of the California.
No.
Okay.
No. I think there are some misperceptions out there, and I've heard some people refer to hydraulic fracturing as creating gushy and spongy rock. That's not accurate. So, just in case you know there's any thoughts out there in that context, I'd like to kind of dispel that. But no, I agree with Dave, and I'm sure Tim agrees with that as well.
Okay. Does Dogger have a jurisdiction on federal lands where there's oil or gas production on federal lands?
Yes, we do. The only case we wouldn't is if the federal government is operating wells on federal land. And we do have some geothermal wells that fall into that category. But when it comes to oil and gas, operators have to comply with both the federal requirements and the state requirements.
Okay. David?
One note on that is that BLM has just released a very, very large number of leases in Monterey and I think San Benito, but I'm not sure. It's mostly Monterey. And there is a lawsuit, I believe, active against BLM for failing to do environmental analysis on its lease outs.
Okay. Although California doesn't have gas production, what should we be concerned about regarding gas fracking in other states?
Let me clarify. California has lots of gas production. Unfortunately, not enough. We import about 83%.
Yeah, well, I was speaking about that earlier. I was speaking in a relative sense,
yeah.
Not in an absolute sense.
What we don't have is we don't have large flat shale-bearing gas formations that are being hydraulically fractured for gas production. But we have gas production from what we call associated gas. That is that picture. I guess I don't have that one. Huh. Well, the one with the anticline, one of the pictures I had that I don't have up there. But on top of the oil, commonly there'll be a gas cap, and that's called associated gas because it's gas that's produced in association with oil. And then up in the Sacramento Basin, we have that's where most of the gas fields are. That they don't have any associated oil. They're just natural gas. But the gas production is from sands for the most part in the state.
Okay. Here's one. I hadn't known about this. What about radium-226? Is it a typical byproduct of fracking, or are other radioactive substances used or produced in fracking? Maybe we could expand that to just be in production generally.
I think this comes out of the Devonian shales, where you had an anaerobic ocean environment with a lot of methylated compounds, and they tend to pick up uranium, among other things, as a trace, and then that breaks down. And so I don't think it's a major issue in California well fields, but I may be wrong.
There was a study by, I think it was the Groundwater Protection Council. It was a peer review. It was either them or the EPA, and it goes back, probably 20 years, where they looked at NORM, naturally occurring radioactive materials in oil field. It's actually a publication. I believe it's on our website, but it really wasn't a significant issue in California oil operations.
Okay. Here's one. Do you have an estimate as to when these regulations that are being discussed applying to these unregulated parts of the fracturing process, or maybe we just say to this process as a whole that's being looked at? What's the timetable that you are foresee for the placement of regulation on hydraulic fracking in California?
Well, the Administrative Procedures Act. I'm not sure I have the name quite right, but once you start a rulemaking, you have 1 year to complete it. So we anticipate starting the rulemaking this summer. We have to complete it within a year, or essentially you have to start the clock over again. We realize we're going to get significant comments. On the discussion draft and our other workshops, we received over 20,000 comments. So we know we will receive lengthy comments. That could make us take the full year. The other kind of wild card in this is no matter what we put in regulation, that'll probably be out in summer, that we anticipate. The legislature could kind of broadside whatever we have in there with legislation that would take effect the first of the year. So that could cause us to start over if it's a significant change in what we have in the regulations, because the regulations can't trump legislation. So if legislation forces us to change course, it could force us to start over.
Anybody else?
Yeah, there are 10 bills out there.
I'll kind of paraphrase these next ones. There were three or four questions that had to do with the Halliburton loop and the exemption that's there. And these questions kind of expressed concern about that and asked, is there something that is the state in a position to put its own regulations in place that maybe can supersede those of the federal government, or has the federal government kind of given this so-called Halliburton loop or Halliburton exemption? Does that exempt these people from state or local control?
I'll take that one. We were just discussing that this morning in my office, and to the best of our knowledge, I haven't consulted with our attorney, but to the best of our knowledge, that given the, quote, Halliburton loophole, the Puerto Cologne Water Quality Act for California is still in full effect. So that really doesn't change much for us in terms of water protection.
Okay.
Our underground injection control regulations are essentially the operating parameter for oil and gas operations when it comes to the Safe Drinking Water Act. So when the 1995 exemption that was put in to remove hydraulic fracturing from the Safe Drinking Water Act, essentially our underground injection control program, that doesn't hinder the state from drafting their own regulations to cover hydraulic fracturing operations. So that's exactly what we're doing with our rulemaking. But we've been very clear that it's not hydraulic fracture stimulation is not regulated in our underground injection control program, because that's for wells that have long-term sustained injection for years and decades. And you can't – hydraulic fracturing stimulation well is a production well that you fracture stimulate once for a few hours perhaps, and then you put it on production. And you can't have a production well following the same regulations as an injection well. And parts of the regulations for an injection well would destroy the reservoir in a producing well. So – to answer the original question, it doesn't trump the state. The state can still regulate hydraulic fracturing operation independent of what the federal government has said.
Okay. Another question, this is on a little different or related matter. Is there the potential for inadvertent release of methane as a possible greenhouse gas impact from hydraulic fracturing, or, and I'll just throw in there, from oil or gas production generally?
Well, the infamous movie Gasland, of course, when we've had that discussed, did show in the gas fields there was leakage. There was an interesting situation in Denver where they are monitoring in downtown Denver the a bunch of carbon isotopes, which were and other gases, which enabled you to show where methane was coming from gas fields and other compounds were coming from gas fields as against other sources, and showed a definite rise when the wind changed to come over the major gas fields. So undoubtedly there is methane leakage from some of the major gas fields out in the rest of the country. How California is handling its leakage issues, I don't know.
Well, that's why I called up the Air District and spoken to Mike Sewell, who regulates San Ardo, and he assures me that they do vapor control. And, you know, it's human, it's not going to be perfect, but in terms of any significant amount, or we're talking about any kind of significant greenhouse gas effect, I don't see that happening.
Okay. Here's a pretty basic one. Does fracking always involve injecting chemicals into the well, or is injection of steam or hot water also considered fracking?
That's you, yeah.
As we've defined hydraulic fracture stimulation in our regulations, you have to have the proppant. So, and to have the proppant, you're going to have generally have to have some kind of chemical mix to suspend the proppant. So the regulations are very specific to hydraulic fracturing stimulation using a proppant. But it is possible to fracture formation with steam. That is another production method. But it wouldn't be covered by these particular regulations. It's probably going to be more covered by our underground injection control regulations, because when you're fracturing with steam, it's in a cyclic steaming well, which is in a well that you steam, put on injection, steam, put on injection. So those are considered injection wells. So maybe that was too much information for a simple question.
Anybody want to add?
No. Okay. Well, I would worry about one thing, and that is that as the weight of California crudes in the Monterey are usually very, very heavy oils, low API, that fracturing itself may not be the issue, but you may in fact be wanting to add diluent, and that means very low density hydrocarbons in order to flush out the oil. So as one increases the volume of oil field that's being processed, you might find a rather more dangerous waste cycle developing where diluent has to be moved into the oil field, used in the well, and then disposed of.
Okay. Just for those who may not be familiar with these terms, and I sort of am, could somebody define the diluent for the audience? And then the other word was the proppant. I think I know what you mean, but I'm not sure I know how to spell it or exactly what it means. Could we get that for those two words, please?
A proppant is it's most typically sand, but it can be ceramics. It's basically just a highly sorted sand particle that's fairly round, fairly small, that they inject during the hydraulic fracturing process into the fractures. And the intent is that sand grain then is inside of this denser shale rock, and when the pressure's taken off, the fractures, if you didn't have proppant in there, the fractures would just close from the overburden. So the sand proppant basically holds that fracture open. And we're talking about fractures like the width of a pencil lead or something like this. That's how big these fractures are. So it basically holds that fracture open so the fluid can move through the fracture to the wellbore. Did you want to talk about diluent?
Diluent is that which dilutes. So it's basically a thinner, okay, like paint thinner.
Is it the pressure of the liquid that cracks up the rock, or what causes the rock to crack?
You guys wondering with me?
What's the physical fracturing?
It's the pressure. You're increasing the pore pressure, and you're exceeding. the pore pressure is exceeding the overburden pressure, so it causes the rock to crack.
Okay. Okay. Who dictates where wells go on public, a federal, or state lands?
If it's on state lands, so property that the state owns, which is, the state has significant mineral royalties underneath lakes and rivers. That's where the state has mineral royalties. So they would, if operators drilling and they're going to directionally drill underneath, like the Sacramento River, which is state lease properties, the state gets royalties into the general fund. You'd still have to go through the local county jurisdiction. As far as if you were drilling on state property where the state had the surface right, the surface control, I believe you'd go through the State Lands Commission. And when it comes to federal lands, it's the BLM or the Forest Service. I don't know if the, I'm not aware that the county has a permitting scheme if you're on, I don't think they have jurisdiction on federal land. So it would be the Forest Service. And I think the Forest Service actually kind of defaults to the BLM rather than have their whole permitting organization in addition, because there's very few wells on Forest Service.
Okay. So is it fair to say that this is on public lands, unless the mineral estate is separated, this is basically public oil and gas, and it is essentially leased or sold by the government and through some sort of a leasing process?
Yeah, yes, it's a leasing process, and then the federal or state government or city government, city of Long Beach, city of Huntington Beach, you know, they get a percentage of the royalties, the sales from the oil.
And I believe the agencies have to maintain their multiple use strategies as well. So it has to be the sitings have to be such they don't destroy other resources, I think, is the general principle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is fracking a land process or can it occur? The question is in the Santa Barbara Channel, let's say, or can it occur? Could it occur under the ocean?
Yes, it can anywhere. Did you have a well? We did have someone say that they didn't want fracking in their backyard, and I asked the lady if she had a well, and she said no. And I said, well, they probably can't frack there. But if you essentially, yes, you could fracture offshore, fracture stimulate. Actually, just to point out, fracture stimulation has also been used in water wells to increase production of water out of water wells. So it's not limited just to oil and gas.
Okay. Anybody want to add? Yeah. Okay, well, I got a couple more here that I've saved sort of for last because they are perhaps taking you guys to task personally and asking you some personal opinion. And I think what I'll do is I'll just merge them into say, is it your opinion that the pros of the use of hydraulic fracturing as a methodology, does it outweigh the cons? Anybody care to tackle that one? We won't hold you to this, you know, in terms of your agencies.
I'll give you one that's sort of a totally different slant, and that is that if you look at the organization 350, and you realize we're hitting now 400 parts per million on CO2, that suddenly making vast quantities of hydrocarbons economically available to the world is going to drive CO2 content wildly higher and way past anything that anyone was going to be predicting 15 years ago before fracking of these other big amorphous oil shales came to being. And this is happening worldwide. So it's scary as far as global CO2 is concerned.
I'll take that as a no. Or maybe. Grant or Tim, would you guys like to, share some of your personal thoughts about it?
As I alluded to earlier, I think it's, you know, and that's looking at it in a way that I often like to refer to it to certain environmental actions is that, I mean, as a state employee, I deal with things on a purely a water quality basis. And what Dave just described is the way I would prefer to look at things, or at least the way I look at things from a private individual side, which is the full comprehensive environmental aspect, not just water quality. Not that water quality is not important, it certainly is, but there is a much more comprehensive way to look at it. And so I can actually appreciate what Dave just alluded to.
Well, I'm not going to share my personal view, but the legislature has given me some pretty clear indication in the statutes that I have to implement. The legislature has actually put in the statute, and this has been there a long time, the ability for industry to increase flow into wells by creating channels or enhancing channels. That's very explicit in the statute. So if you look at the statute, the legislature said, industry, you can hydraulically fracture stimulate. I think that would be a fairly easy argument for industry to make in any kind of challenge. Now, that doesn't mean that industry's preempted from the other mandate that's in statute, and that is they have to operate not to damage life, health, and property. So I'm just focusing really in on our on the legislation that we operate under. We do not set the energy policy for the state at all. That is nowhere close to our agency's mission. But it's clear in our statute that hydraulic fracturing stimulation is allowed, but it has to be done safely. I can talk very briefly about what my boss, who appointed me and who is the governor of the state, indicated. He says hydraulic fracturing can be done, and it can be done safely, and that it shouldn't be outright banned. That's the position of this administration. So that's about all I can share with you. That is not at all any of my personal opinion.
Okay. Well, that kind of wraps it up. I would like to just let you know that this program has been videotaped by AGP, and will be shown at some point here in the very near future on, I think it'll be on Channel 21. And we thanks to AGP for doing this. They gave us a nice discount to the league for their setup and everything, and we greatly appreciate that. Panelists can stick around for a few minutes. I know we didn't ask all of the questions. If you really want to get your question answered by one of the panelists, please come on up and you can ask them. But we have one last thing to do, and I'll have my wife Ann come up to do that.
We just have a little token of appreciation for you to spend your time off coming and giving us this great program. And we're so grateful that it will be shown continually or periodically on public television, our local community television. And it's just a great opportunity for the league to be able to host this.
So thank you, everybody, for coming, and we really appreciate. We know there are lots of things you could have been doing tonight, and we appreciate you coming out to join us.